You're listening to the Shared Security Show, exploring the trust you put in people and technology with your hosts, Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. Every hack follows the same pattern. First, hackers exploit a human error, like a leaked key or a secret left in code. They gain a foothold and then pivot, moving from one compromised system to the next. Teleport breaks this cycle. Open source Teleport gives every engineer, every piece of hardware, every application an identity, replacing secrets like passwords and keys with auto-expiring identity-based certificates. Learn why the most visionary businesses in the world choose Teleport at goteleport.com. Welcome to this week's very special episode of the Shared Security Show. And joining me this week are several very special guests. We have Caitlin Johansson and Rick Osgood from Coalfire. We have Larry Pesci from InGuardians. And of course, our two fabulous co-hosts, Scott Wright and Kevin Johnson.
I forgot that Tom likes the word fabulous.
I do. I love calling you gentlemen fabulous for various reasons. But this week we have a very interesting topic. We'll be discussing ham, and specifically ham hacking. Ham and pineapple, which go very well together, as you can see if you're on the YouTube watching Caitlin here, dressed as a pineapple. I don't know where the ham is. Someone was supposed to dress as a ham, but
Larry's pretty handy.
Yes. But we are actually going to be talking about hacking ham radio, which is a fascinating topic that I don't think we've ever mentioned ham radio on the show.
We have not.
In the 12 plus years we've been recording this, guys.
We're breaking
this maybe a first. We are.
I'd like to believe that we've mentioned it at least once, but yes. I don't know if we have.
We might have said the word radio, but I don't think we've said ham.
We've definitely said the word radio. That is an absolute.
Guaranteed several times.
And as a fat guy, I love ham. So we've definitely mentioned food.
Ham is delicious. Do agree with you on that. So
it's made from the same magical animal as bacon. I mean, yeah, it's not to love.
But it's not quite bacon.
Unless you're in Canada, right?
Yes, Canadian bacon.
Yeah, that's not real bacon. That's another example of the Canadians lying to themselves to think they're better.
We're just appropriating all your culture. Yeah.
After you burn our White House down, my goodness.
Oh, we love our northern neighbors, of course. But before we get into the topic, I do want to just introduce, I know Caitlin and Rick from Coalfire, I know Caitlin, thank you for sending me the note about ham radio. I know there was a blog that you had done, Rick, on hacking ham radio. I think it's part one of probably a couple of blogs, right, that you're doing on that?
Yep, it was a five-part series. That's all on there now, so you can read it all if you have.
Well, awesome.
It's all public.
Excellent.
Now.
But yeah, Caitlin and Rick, you want to talk a little bit about what you guys do at Coalfire?
Sure. So I don't do much. I'm the VP of application security.
She's a VP.
Rick's the pretty face here that, you know, I'm complimenting the ham. You know, the pineapples too.
So then I'm the ham, I guess. I'm a principal consultant at Coalfire. I mostly do web application testing these days, web apps, APIs, stuff like that. But occasionally get into the R&D stuff, which is kind of how I got into all this ham stuff through Coalfire's R&D program. So
excellent.
I don't even QA reports anymore, so I don't know
what to do. You're too high up in the chain now, Caitlin. Yeah, see how that happens.
Fucking pineapple.
And for our audience that doesn't know Larry Pesci,
Larry, if you don't know Larry, you're missing.
I know if you don't know Larry, I mean, yeah, that's a big
come
problem.
On.
But I'll let Larry introduce himself for everyone.
Awesome. Thanks, Tom. So Larry Pesci, I'm the Director of Research and Development at InGuardians. So I get to do all sorts of management-y type things, as well as actually try to do some fun stuff around some research and help the team, you know, figure out what they're going to work on for some research stuff. But I'm also a practitioner. So I do pen testing and sort of Wi-Fi, radio, IoT has been my specialty over the last number of years. And I also teach the wireless and the IoT hacking class, and I'm a co-author on both of those for SANS.
I feel like I have to say that Larry is one of the people who inspired me and supported me in joining this career. He is one of the people that I credit for being why I'm here. And I used to work for InGuardians. I will say that InGuardians is one of the few companies we actually list on our website as who you should hire if you don't hire us. And Larry's awesome. I just got to say it.
Thanks, Kevin. You're going to give me a big head. I'm not going to be able to get out of my office pretty soon here.
Well, you know.
Or overinflate my ego or something. I'm like, geez.
And Larry is also a podcaster.
Yes.
Long history of podcasting. Security yes. Weekly, the old Paul.com.
Paul.com. So, are you allowed to call it that?
Used to listen to
it. Don't tell Rand Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going into our 16th year of Security Weekly.
Now. Yep.
So.
Very cool.
Fun stuff.
Very cool. So let's talk about ham radio, and maybe for our audience, can maybe someone explain what is ham radio, and I guess why is this still relevant? Because, you know, when you think of ham radio, you think of your grandfather in his garage, you know, turning old tubes and things and talking to people on the other side of the world.
Talking to people in the future, in the usually.
When you didn't have all this technology. But let's talk about what is ham radio.
Well, for me, it's more of a hobby. I mean, ham radio in general, it's like a non-commercial, specifically designed to be non-commercial. You're using radios just to communicate with other people, whether that be using your voice or using a computer, Morse code, you know, whatever it may be. The government sets aside some certain frequency ranges that are allotted for this, and you get a license, you get on the air, and, you know, within certain parameters, you can operate on those frequencies. And because it's non-commercial, it's sort of protected also from like other companies or commercial interests can't just commandeer those frequencies and use them for whatever they want. They're open to amateurs to do basically like hobby usage, experimentation. It also is used sometimes in emergencies. Hams will get together. There's different ham, like emergency response groups that'll get together, and they like a lot of times natural disasters, like some of the big hurricanes that happened down in the Southeast USA. Groups will come together and help coordinate communications to areas where maybe there's a blackout or something and they can't get communications any other way offshore. Like I think when the hurricane hit Puerto Rico, there was some ham involvement there.
Absolutely. Yeah, the initial establishment of the amateur community and so forth by the government here in the U.S. Was specifically for experimentation in the effort of being able to support disaster communications and so forth. So that's really sort of where it's gotten its foothold for that disaster communications. But folks started using it for so much more and a great way to communicate, and arguably still a great way to communicate today. I mean, what happens when we become so reliant on, you know, the wires coming into our house and 5G, and what happens when some of that stuff goes away? Because it requires some significant power. And we're often able to do really long range communication over the horizon with very low output power on ham radio stuff running off of something like a car battery. So very cool. Inexpensive.
Yeah, you don't really need much like infrastructure. You know, you get a radio and a power supply, and you throw like a wire up in a tree, and you're talking to someone on the other side of the country or in a different country entirely, without needing to be plugged into the internet or a phone line or a cable or whatever. You know, it's just you and you're on a hilltop or something, and it's kind of magic that it works. Like for me, it's like black magic. Anyway, I don't fully understand it. I know how to use it a little bit, but I don't really understand it.
Oh, if you got your ham radio license, you understand it just enough.
Just enough, yeah.
So I guess that brings you the question of like, so why would someone want to hack ham radio, right? Like, what are the benefits in terms of like, I'm an attacker. Obviously, there's emergency services and things that it's still used for, and you know, all those use cases. But what's the appeal, I guess, of hacking ham radio?
Well, I mean, for me, it was just for fun. I'm just, you know, I'm a security guy, and I dabble in ham radio. It's one of many different hobbies I have. On and off, I kind of jump into it, and usually if I mess in with the ham radio, it's some kind of digital communication. It's just for me, I'm not super into making voice contacts, but I'm usually hooking up to a computer and trying to talk to another computer or something, and so naturally my brain went to, like, I wonder if I could get a shell on this computer over the radio. Like, how, it's got to be, like, technically, it has to be possible. I mean, everything's broken somehow, you know. But until last year, I didn't really have the skill set to, like, dive into that, really. So, yeah, for me, it was more of a curiosity. In the real world, it's an attack. It's just another attack vector. Like, it's another door into a system or a network that maybe hadn't been considered before. You know, you kind of think of, I've got all these websites publicly exposed, so let's lock those down, keep them updated, firewall them off, whatever we got to do, because those are likely to get breached, and that's a foothold into our network. I know a couple years ago, I think it was Checkpoint did some research on, like, fax machines, and they found some vulnerabilities in fax machines that I hadn't seen anyone do before. So it's like, I can send you a malicious fax, and now I've got a foot in your network over the phone line through your fax machine, and you wouldn't have maybe thought of that before, right? It's another way in that wasn't there. And ham radio is just like an extension of that, maybe a more obscure one. Now, I don't know how many systems are on sensitive networks hooked up to ham radio, you know, per se, but I imagine there are some. And as we mentioned with, like, disasters, scenarios and stuff, it may be more relevant, yeah, in like a time of distress.
Yeah, so to Rick, to add to some of that as well, you know, thinking about this from maybe an enterprise security standpoint, I do know of a number of hospitals, and I'm not sure if they still are, but in the past they had been using ham radio in some hospitals in Texas and a few other places to create backup links. Should any other infrastructure be down, to be able to exchange medical records and do, you know, planning around disasters and large scale event type of things. So that could be kind of interesting, and if those things are up and tested with some regularity, you know, thinking about some of the things that you had in your article, like, that's a valid attack vector potentially into some enterprise. But I think about all of those other things that we are using radio for when we start talking cellular communications and IoT and even IoT adjacent type of stuff. That are using some form of radio to take data into, you know, something that's connected to a network or something connected to something critical, that using those same sort of techniques and that same sort of, you know, thought process that you had in your articles could be used as an attack vector into something critical.
And you mentioned the hospitals. That triggers something in my brain, because to the best of my knowledge on ham radio, you're not allowed to encrypt your messages. Like, that's one Correct. Of the limitations by the FCC. So if a hospital's backing up data over an unencrypted radio link, what kind of data is that? And, like, hopefully it's not my data.
Hospitals don't have anything sensitive. No, it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, and it's not like hospitals send anything over the public airwaves that you can receive with an expensive equipment that isn't encrypted already. POCSEC.
You want your organization to be secure and compliant and to have a healthy culture, but your employees' lack of awareness makes you vulnerable to data theft, fraud, and compliance penalties. It's frustrating that the boring static training content that's being used today has failed to improve employees' ability to defend against cyber attacks. At ClickArmor, we know that without using gamification, it's extremely hard to get staff to understand how to avoid threats. Our gamified simulations and challenges have provided a 50% average improvement in thousands of employees' ability to spot phishing threats. Go to clickarmor.ca/sharedsecurity to get your free gamified phishing assessment for up to 500 employees. You'll see quickly how gamified simulations can help your team be more resilient and compliant and help avoid costly ransomware and fraud incidents. Let ClickArmor help you go from being an underappreciated, stressed out fall guy to being an innovative leader who's the catalyst for greater productivity in your organization.
So that kind of leads me to another, you know, a couple other things you'd mentioned just around packet radio and this thing called APRS, Automatic Packet Reporting System. Can you talk a little bit about what those things are?
Yeah. So there's various ways to communicate over ham radio digitally. Packet radio generally refers to this protocol AX25, and it's a like a data link layer protocol. So you could sort of think of it as a replacement for Ethernet. You can actually tunnel TCP/IP over it if you want to. But it breaks down your data into packets similar to how Ethernet works, sends them, you know, you receive them. And then you can run other protocols on top of that. Like I mentioned, TCP/IP, APRS is another protocol that runs on AX25. And like for me, I got into it actually. This is actually the reason I got my license was back when I was graduating in school. Professor of mine put together a class where we were building a high altitude balloon and we needed a way to track it. And APRS is often used for tracking GPS coordinates. Like a lot of hams will have a tracker in their vehicle and they'll just be driving around, sending out their location just for the fun of it. And so we decided to use that for our balloon. So we put a little radio on the balloon and a little GPS unit, a little modem. And this thing's like 90,000 feet in the air and we're tracking it from the ground, trying to chase it down, you know, as it hits the jet stream and stuff. So it's often used for GPS. It's also often used for weather, telemetry data. You can send short text messages with it. Generally, it's usually seeing it on 2 meter band, which is more local. So it's kind of like shorter range stuff, data that's probably more relevant to the immediate area. But there are systems called digipeaters that can pick up your packet and then repeat it out further based on certain things, certain ways you configure the packet. You can kind of tell it like how far you want your packet to be repeated, how many times you want it repeated, which can extend the range. And some of those repeaters are also iGates, which are bridged to the internet, where there's this sort of APRS backbone network where all of these iGates will they take your packets and they kind of put them all onto this backbone. And then you can go, like there's a website called aprs.fi that uses Google Maps and you can just type in like any place in the world and it'll show you all the APRS packets that it's received for that region. And since most regions have like a standard frequency they use APRS on, so like in the States, it's 144.390. So if you tune in there in any like populated area, you'll just hear packets going like constantly. And digipeaters just all sort of listen on that same frequency and it kind of helps the network grow, I guess. But yeah, primarily short text messages.
And speaking of that network growing, right around the time of some of the military operations of Russia into Ukraine, someone in Eastern Europe was playing around with APRS and spammed hundreds of thousands of APRS messages for false devices and locations. APRS.fi had all of those things up there, and it was amazing.
Wow.
So yet another attack, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's disruption.
Yeah, totally. I mean, these are things that a lot of people don't realize. I mean, wireless attacks in general, I think, are often just more overlooked these days because, you remember like 10 years ago or so, wireless was like, oh, everyone's got Wi-Fi networks at their home. So now that's an attack vector. But it's become so commonplace that I don't think we think of these things anymore as another way to attack an organization or an individual. And I'm fascinated by ham radio because just hearing all these stories definitely makes you realize that there are organizations that may be using this and not understanding kind of the security ramifications of what they've set up.
So I have a silly question. Sorry, I just have a silly question. So why is that APRS channel or those channels not completely overrun with abusive people like all the time?
Well, that's another thing about ham radio is you have to be licensed. So you've got to, you got to pay, you got to take a test, you get a license. I mean, technically you could operate without a license, right? It'd be illegal. And the ham's sort of self-policing. So when they see that kind of behavior, even with like an actual licensed ham, they have channels to report it. I forget what it's called. Something observer. There are certain people who are kind of signed up to do that, I guess. And they have a some sort of chain of command where they can report these things up, and then they don't have the ability to actually do much about it other than report it. And then the FCC can kind of step in and fine, or I don't know, maybe jail or something, depending on the severity, I guess. But I think the licensing is a good first barrier to just that kind of general, just like trolling, I guess. But secondly, like, you know, there are laws against that kind of thing, and people will step in if you're really bad about it.
Just curious how they enforce that stuff.
There's a little bit of a barrier to entry into, you know, some of the equipment. I mean, it's not huge, but there is a little bit of a cost associated with being able to do some transmissions and so forth.
Yeah, so that was one of my questions is, you know, what kind of hardware, say someone's interested just entry level, like wanting to get more into ham radio, like what's kind of the hardware requirements around that?
I mean, you could get, like, nowadays, like there's this company Baofeng that you hear a lot about. They're like these really cheap little like $15, $20 handheld little walkie-talkie thing. But they're ham radios. They do work. They're really like dirt cheap. You can get them on like any, you know, any website, really any site that sells anything for like Amazon or whatever would sell them. And you can get on the air super cheap. Or at least you can start listening. You know, if you don't have a license, you can listen. Like, there's nothing against listening to any frequency. Anybody can do that. If you want to transmit on the ham bands, then you need a license. But otherwise, yeah, just like a little $20 handheld transceiver will get you started, at least for local communications. If you want to get into digital work, probably like the cheapest way to go is you can install like a software modem on your computer. So something like Direwolf is an open source one, or there's another one, AGW Packet Engine. And basically what that does is you hook your radio. You need a way to hook your radio's output into your computer microphone input and vice versa. And then if your radio has like a voice on transmit function where it'll automatically transmit when you speak into it, that helps a lot. And you can configure the software and say like, okay, every time one of my ham packet software wants to send a packet, it talks to your soft modem. The soft modem actually modulates the signal into audio, sends it out the mic or out the speaker port. The radio hears that, automatically keys up, and then transmits in the same and the opposite direction. So it takes a lot of tweaking to get that set up just right, get your audio levels right and everything. But it's really cheap. Probably the cheapest way to get on is like find a cheap radio with the inputs and output ports, hook it up to your computer, install some free software, and you can get going like, you know, under $50. Otherwise, you could buy an actual TNC modem, which is going to be, they're kind of like dumb expensive for the fact that you're getting like 1200 baud and you're paying like $100 or whatever for a TNC. You know, the one I bought like 10 years ago was it was from the 90s and I paid $70 for it. And I bought it 10 years ago and I was like, why is it so expensive? But they just kind of are for whatever reason. But it's a little easier to work with. But yeah, the price obviously goes up a little there. And the radios just, you know, you can spend thousands on a single radio. You can buy radios that have their own modems built in and digital functions and like all kinds of stuff, like built-in touch screens and things, you know, but then you're looking at like over $1,000 probably for a lot of that kind of stuff.
Like any good hobby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and I run some semi-vintage gear from out of the late 80s, early 90s, and a laptop, same sort of thing, you know, sound card, input to output, output to input, and let the software on the computer do all that stuff. And Windows is a big choice for all of the ham radio folks, but Linux is starting to get a little bit there. So
nice.
Lots of free stuff, you know, potentially over the horizon stuff. You're talking, you know, a couple $100s. The over the horizon stuff really gets to be about having space to have some antenna room. So, local stuff. You're talking definitely under $50. You can spend more, like, you know, that Baofeng. I have one that I think was $35. It goes in my backpack. So when I travel, if it gets broken, it's $35. But I have the $300 Yaesu that sits on my desk and I use that when I'm, you know, less worried about it getting broken. So yeah, there's all sorts of price range, but yeah, it's a reasonable hobby to get into nowadays.
Yeah, so if you can find a local ham club, I mean, most of the people in those clubs are really friendly and they really want new people to get involved in the hobby because I think there's a general sense that maybe it's dying or something. I think that's maybe not so true nowadays with all the new digital stuff, but yeah, if you can find a local club, I mean, people there will probably have gear they'll sell you cheap, or maybe they even have some old radio they'll just give you because they're excited that there's a new person wanting to get involved, so...
Yeah. And what are the licensing requirements? Like, where do you go take a test? Like, how does that all work?
I got mine through a local club at the time. That's, I think that's usually how it works. And I guess I don't know what it costs now. At the, like in 2008, it cost about $14. And you take, there's like three different levels of ham license. Each one gives you a little bit more access to more frequency ranges that you, so you can kind of do more. But each test is more technical and difficult. Like the base level technical license is pretty easy. It's mostly just FCC rules, things you would need to know to operate legally. A lot of common, it's common sense stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Common sense.
My favorite question from my exam, knowing that the ham radio, service, amateur service, was intended to help emergency communications, one of the questions that I had on my exam, which the questions are public and they're available with all of the answers, was, you're talking on your ham radio on 2 meters and someone breaks in saying that they have an emergency. What do you do? A, turn on your amplifier and drown them out. B,
yes.
Tell them to go away and find another frequency. This one's in use. C, ignore them. D, help them to the best of your ability.
I don't know which of the first three are the right answer, but I know it's not the fourth one.
So
there was no option for call 911. Okay.
That may be help to the best of your ability.
That would fall under D, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So like, the tech level questions are pretty much common sense. There's a little bit of technical stuff you need to know, but yeah, then the general gets a little bit more technical, and the extra is even more technical than that.
Yeah,
and you don't need Morse code anymore. You don't need to know that these days.
Oh, really?
So there's I think that scares a lot of people away, but you don't at least 10 years now. You haven't needed that.
That was actually what kept me from doing it years ago. Was because I, for some reason, have always struggled. I tried to learn Morse code when I was younger, and I don't know if it's a mental block. I could not remember Morse code. And so I just stayed away from it. I didn't realize that.
Yep. Well, there you go. Yes.
Yeah. I want to say it's been closer to like 15 or more years that we have the requirement for Morse code. I mean, when I got mine, there was no requirement. It hadn't been for a number of years.
It's been a while.
Does anybody else think it's funny that technician is less difficult than general? Like, every time I hear that, I think to myself, no, that's not right. That's backwards.
That's a good
nowadays,
point, yeah.
Nowadays, extra really is, well, extra, right?
Very cool. Yeah, I think they do the test at DEF CON, don't they? Don't they offer it?
Yeah.
They do.
Yep.
There's a ham radio village there.
Yep. They've also done testing in person at ShmooCon and DerbyCon and
very cool.
DerbyCon was in process. I know they were doing in person testing. COVID changed a lot of those rules. So I think many of the clubs are doing semi-virtual. Like, I know some of the clubs during COVID, like, you'd show up to the testing site, you'd stay in your car, they'd hand you an exam, you'd do it in your car, and then you'd hand it back to them. They were all paper exams. But I think they have some options for doing, like, online semi-proctored tests now.
Nice. Very cool. Well, we will have links to a lot of the things that were discussed in the podcast in our show notes, of course, unless there is, of course, one giant link of ham information one of you know about that you'd like to share. But yeah, and of course, we'll have a link to your blog, Rick, your blog series on ham radio.
Cool.
This is great. But fascinating topic. And, of course, I want to thank you all for being on the show. This was like a mini reunion for several of us. So thank you, Caitlin, for bringing us all together once again. We will try to make this not as every couple years we see each other, but maybe we can hopefully see each other more often now that I'm not saying the pandemic is over, but is it ever to be over? But hopefully we can all see each other.
35,000 people in San Francisco would say it is.
Yeah, says the 30,000 people at RSA right now. Yeah. But thank you all for being on the show. And for everyone else, we'll talk to everyone next week.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app, or leave us a rating and review. To catch all the latest from the show, visit our website, sharedsecurity.net, for all show notes and previous episodes. Follow us on Twitter at SharedSec, and join our Reddit community on the Shared Security Show subreddit. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another episode of the Shared Security Show.